It's time for Wonks. From the Noche Jazz Cabaret in Des Moines, Iowa, it's the monthly, just-for-fun gathering of political insiders. Now, Wonks.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Wonks, our sometimes lighthearted and often incisive, always interesting look at politics from a unique Iowa perspective. I'm Kevin Cooney.
And I'm Dennis Goldford. We're coming to you from the Noche Jazz Club in downtown Des Moines. The topic for this edition, which is a hot topic for a frigid night, is politics and the press. It's a bizarre relationship in many ways. One of our panelists called it parasitic, others symbiotic.
And these days, the back and forth between the press and the White House seems to be, as well, as Dennis said, bizarre. And calling it that is not fake news, okay?
But maybe some will disagree tonight. Here's our panel. First of all, Aaron Murphy is the Des Moines Bureau Chief for Lee Newspapers, which means he's the state government and political reporter for readers in Mason City, Burlington, Muscatine, and more. Aaron, admit it here and now, you are biased. You are a Wisconsin fan.
I have definite bias.
Which is true. Be careful what you put on your Facebook pages. It's all filled with Wisconsin.
So. Yeah, nobody will throw anything if I do one of these, right? I've lived my whole life in Wisconsin and Iowa, and I'll say this, I find it funny. You know, when sports fans and that rivalry starts to heat up, Wisconsins and Iowans are like separated at birth. They're the same people, but boy, during that week, you wouldn't know it. And I don't mind drawing the distinction that week either.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. Michael Gartner is a former editor at the Des Moines Register, former president at NBC News, former owner of the Ames Daily Tribune. There's a lot of former things here.
Yeah, Michael. Couldn't hold a job.
A Pulitzer Prize-winning editorialist, he is currently chairman and principal owner of the Iowa Cubs. And Michael, it begs the question, which is the better game, politics or baseball?
Opening day is April 5th against Oklahoma City. Good tickets still available. Opening, the time is at 3:08. I would point out that all the games start on the 08 because we sold the starting times to Channel 8.
Yay!
Proof you can sell anything, can't you? Carol Hunter is the executive editor of the Des Moines Register, where she oversees news coverage for the paper and online as well. Previously, she has been editorial page editor and politics editor. Carol, 10 days after Donald Trump was elected, you were named executive editor. Coincidence or not?
Well, coincidence. My predecessor got a wonderful promotion, opening up the job for me, and I'm very honored to have it. But let's just say that covering Mr. Trump as a candidate was an adventure, and so has been covering his presidency.
Thanks, Carol.
Yes. Well, speaking of not holding a job, as Michael said, the average tenure for a television news director is 5 years. Dave Buzik of KCCI-TV has held that position at that station for 28 years. KCCI?
Which tells you how old he is, folks.
Oh, my God, yes. Has won National Edward R. Murrow Reporting Awards, and Buzik himself has been named National News Director of the Year. And received a Silver Circle Award winner by the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Oh, really old. Wrote for outstanding contributions to the industry and so forth. Dave, again, I have to ask you, where would you put a third mitten?
Where would I put a third mitten? On a night like tonight, you could be forgiven putting a third mitten anywhere you needed.
Should we elaborate any more than that?
Well, it was a night like tonight, and Connie, the weather lady, said, you're going to need to take your mittens tomorrow. And then she comes back to the anchor desk with two men, Kevin and me, sitting there. And she says, in fact, it's going to be so cold, you might want to bring three mittens. And then she looks at the two men and says, where would you wear a third mitten anyway?
Sweet Connie.
I panicked. Kevin did what Kevin does. He takes a bad situation and makes it worse and says, your nose? And
hey, it was trying to sound innocent. All right, thanks, Dave. You know, we've kind of turned the tables here a little bit from our previous shows. Instead of having reporters with Dennis and myself asking questions, we have asked the chairs of the state political parties to be with us. Republican Chairman Jeff Kaufman was one of our advertised questioners. As our audience here knows, Jeff has come down with that awful stuff that is floating around the state, sends his apologies, but he also sends in his place Matt Strawn, a former state GOP chair and who was actually on the other side of this particular table during our first Wonks broadcast. And joining him is the current Iowa Democratic chair, Troy Price, who may be sitting on that side of the stage next month. We're thinking about doing a thing on caucuses, and so maybe, Troy, he can do that. But let's hear it for our respective chairs here. For sure.
Before we let our chairs check in, let's set our base. So, Carol Hunter, let's start with you. What's the media's role in covering politics? What should you all be doing?
Well, the media, as always, asks questions. We try to inform. We try to hold politicians and candidates and office holders accountable. We do think that the Fourth Estate has a role in our democracy and in holding candidates and office holders accountable.
Michael Gartner, do you agree, or is there more to say?
The role of the newspaper is to find the facts and print them in the news columns and to run fact-based opinion on the editorial page and then let the chips fall where they may.
Matt, do they do it? Well, from the party standpoint, how well do they do it?
Well, first, sitting here, I have an academic on one side. I've got the Democratic chair on the other side. I've got a room full of esteemed Fourth Amendment, our Fourth Estate professionals.
No, this is a search and seizure crowd. So.
This is, I tell you, this is the epitome of a road game for this Republican. And I guess, kind of keeping with that, maybe keeping with that sports analogy, when I think about what the role of the media is. And a lot of times you heard, okay, maybe their job is to call the balls and strikes of a particular public policy debate in addition to just, reciting the facts of something that's in dispute. Well, I think we veered a little bit from that when you talk about, how are they doing today with the media writ large. And I think we'll probably talk a little bit more about the national scene than perhaps here locally. But think about what is driving everybody crazy with the NFL games perhaps they watched this weekend. We're tired of the replays, we're tired of seeing the referees on TV more than the players, and we're tired of being, that's what's talked about the day after the game. We're seeing the same thing happening in our politics right now. And I think as someone who, actually graduated from J school at the University of Iowa, so I had some level of education as a journalist, seeing that deviation from perhaps, what I heard previously described is something that I think is frustrating not just to Republicans, but for those news consumers and voters that don't want the media to be the story, to insert them in the story day in and day out. And I think too often on the national scene right now, that's what we're seeing as opposed to giving us the facts, calling the balls and strikes.
But who's inserting the media into the story? Is it the media that's inserting themselves, or is it Donald Trump and everybody else who's inserting the media?
Well, I know your TV's tuned to Channel 8 morning, noon, and night, but just flip on cable. Right now, when you have White House correspondents for cable news networks standing up at press conferences, daily news briefings, and making them the story, themselves the story.
So
the media, reporting
what are you talking
on
about?
Each other.
An example.
Well, that's one thing about somebody that's still in the business to some degree. I'm not going to name names, but everybody knows what I'm talking about.
Name names.
I really don't. I'm wondering about at a news conference,
Jim
a reporter from, standing up and
Jim
inserting
Acosta
himself
from CNN
herself.
Has made a cottage industry out of this.
I think part of the problem, Matt, I agree with you, is that with all some of the cable networks are owned by some of the broadcast networks, and whereas on the broadcast networks you're supposed to be straight down the middle like Tom Brokaw, but then increasingly those people are showing up on the cable networks and offering their opinions, and once you're a news guy who offers an opinion on national television, you're sort of tainted.
Is there a different role, Dave Buzik, for television as opposed to newspapers and what the media's role is in covering politics or covering government?
No, I really don't think so. I think it's largely the same. I think what's happened in cable news over the past 5 to 10 years is not necessarily healthy. It feels like it's way more discussion and opinion as opposed to just covering what's going on. I mean, you would think there's nothing else going on in the world other than what's happening at the White House these days. So in that regard, I think it's different.
But it's a business, Dave.
It is a business, and as we talked about earlier, CNN ratings are up, CNN profits are up through the roof. So,
is this why you don't see any news on CNN or MSNBC or Fox after 6 o'clock at night?
It appears to be working.
That's why you can trust newspapers. Our profits are terrible.
Get that man some cheese curds and a spotted cow.
Troy Price, what about a Democratic perspective on this?
Well, listen, I mean, I think that the media has done a very good job over the last 18 months since we've seen Trump elected. I think that the problem is that the president just keeps injecting the media into this. I mean, we saw that in that one of those first press conferences when that woman asked, I can't remember the reporter's name, but she asked whether the president would be meeting with the Congressional Black Caucus. And the president, you know, says, well, you set it up. Well, I mean, you know, she didn't want to be the story, but she was the story because President Trump made her that story. And so I think that, you know, I get what you're trying to say, Matt, but I think that at the end of the day, the press is really trying to figure out how to operate in this world, this Trump world, where, you know, they don't want to be the story. They want to report on the news, but the president just keeps making them the news.
All right. Go ahead. Well, you want to check in?
Listen, I don't think what we've seen, and again, we'll keep the lens focused on some of the national media outlets. This didn't happen when Trump was inaugurated as president. We saw this happen in the context of the caucus and the primary process, where the cable news networks made a business decision that if Donald Trump was going to have a press conference, they were going to roll footage live. We had never seen that before. They didn't do that for any other Republican candidates that were running. They did it as a business-based decision because conflict was good for business. So if you're trying to present the facts and let the voters decide, we did not see large national media conglomerates making that decision. They were more focused on delivering shareholder value than delivering the news to America.
Michael, would you check in on this?
I go back to something Troy said? He said that they don't want to be, what did you say, Troy? They don't want to be the news?
Be the
of course they want to be the story.
The journalists do?
Well, I think MSNBC and Fox certainly want to be the story, and probably CNN, they want to be the story. Yeah, it brings in viewers, it brings in advertisers, sure.
But is it more than a business thing, Michael? Are they trying to change policy? Are they trying to change the government?
No, I think
they're just trying to make money.
They're not trying to change any policy. They're trying to get ratings, and they're trying to make money.
Really? That's all it is? Because you would have, I mean, I'm just saying,
well,
the reason
I
ask
yeah.
is because you would have people who would say that MSNBC and that Fox are trying to actually change the government or trying to.
No. I don't think they're trying to change anything. I think they're trying to be outraged because outrage and shouting seems to work, but doesn't work in my family. But No, I think they're just trying. It's a way to bring in viewers and money and then to make their stars famous and be on the cover of People magazine.
Well, it was the case ages ago, was it not, that news divisions, particularly of networks, were considered loss leaders. Basically, they were separate from the profit-driven entertainment shows and so forth. Given what you said, Michael Gartner, it sounds as if the corporatization of news or the business model, and I agree somebody's got to pay to turn the lights on and keep the mics on, that seems to undermine the kind of function of the news of the press that Carol talked about, I think, in terms of...
Well, first of all, to say that news is a loss leader, you have to say, define news. I got in an argument when I was at NBC. My mission was to make it break even, and they kept changing the definition of break even. But we started a primetime show, and it was making a lot of money, and that wasn't credited to me. So I said to my boss, why not? And he said, well, that's in Brandon's time. Brandon Tartikoff ran primetime. And I said, well, Christ, I'm putting it on. And he said, well, if you look at it that way, he says, I can make it so you make $100, $200, $300 million a year. And I said, how? And he says, Cheers is a news show. And, you know, what could I say? It's all one big operation, you know. It's like saying, does the editorial page make money? Does it?
I would be hard-pressed to say it makes money.
but you got to have it.
Carol, what about the profitability of newspapers? We've been reading and been seeing over the past several years, we have seen newspapers fold, just as we did see newspapers fold when the afternoon edition started folding. Now we're seeing entire morning newspapers in Seattle and San Francisco, places like this, just disappear, or at least assume an online presence. So does the Register make money?
The Register makes money.
How much?
I'm not going to talk about that. That's certainly true, not as much as I used to. And I think what's important is to say news and not newspaper, because what's important to me is that we put out a credible news report. And that news report now goes to a desktop computer, it goes to your mobile phone, it goes to apps. It goes to mobile web. We have more readers of our content than we ever have historically. If you just say who clicked on content produced by the Des Moines Register.
How do you know they read it?
We can measure that very, very closely, more so than you could ever measure who actually read a story in a print product. Sometimes it makes you very happy what they read. Our investigative reporting is very well read, and it has a long scroll depth and long engagement time. But then they watch a lot of cat videos, too.
Are there click quotas? Are there click quotas for the reporters, Carol?
Not quotas. There are goals. We want to...
We wouldn't accept that from our field staff.
We want to grow our audience. You know, is that bad? I think every reporter wants more people to read what they're writing.
Okay.
And that's what we're aiming for.
What happens if a reporter doesn't make their goal?
There are talks and coaching and guidance. And there are certainly different beats. Our university sports beats and breaking news beats get a heck of a lot more clicks than your standard coverage of metropolitan government, say. But we still have metro government reporters.
So if your kids are thinking of going to journalism school, learn breaking news and sports coverage.
Well, so actually, you know, I have a...
Go ahead, Price. Troy Price.
Troy Price. I have a question then, Carol, about that. Like, how does... Because I get this question a lot from people in politics, people who are running for office. They're trying to break through. They're trying to get earned media. Certainly, I've been on, when I worked in the governor's office, I'm sure I called you a few times, hounding you to come to a press conference or two. If the politics stuff isn't getting as much coverage as, say, cat videos or investigative journalism, you know, how should someone try to break through? Like what, and I guess this is a question really for everyone. How can someone try to break through, get on your folks' radar screen, get on your assignment desk for that day to try and get their story out?
I think it's still largely the same, is that a candidate has to try to control their own destiny by their activity. You know, do they hold press conferences? Are they meeting with county chairs? Are they out holding town meetings? That sort of thing. Have they got an active mailing list? How many county chairs have they recruited? We try to measure and get a handle on that kind of activity to kind of establish a baseline of the seriousness of that person's candidacy. And then there are tools like the Iowa poll to in a more scientific manner see how a candidate is doing.
Well, I'm going to actually, let me drill down on that a little bit, because you indicated you very clearly are getting guidance on what your reporters need to do to drive up their numbers from a click and metric standpoint. What types of things are you telling your reporters that they need to be writing about and covering to drive those clicks in local government and in politics? Is it conflict? Is it the policy conflict? Is it fundraising in the horse race? What do you see drive those metrics and encourage the reporters to pursue?
One thing that we look at now is we try to go back to our audience of readers and look at what are they most interested in. If you look at something like the local level, say Windsor Heights sidewalks became a very big local issue. And so you're looking, you could call that conflict. It became a conflict. But it also was about safety of children walking to school. It was about taxation. And so it's trying to keep continually figuring out what does the audience really want and think they need to know.
But what about what
Michael
they...
Michael Gardner.
Excuse me. What about what they ought to know, not what they want to know? I mean, how do you deal with that? My family's here.
I mean, I think, say, our editorial pages and commentary, that's, I think, where a lot of what they ought to know comes into play. I mean, I do think at times we risk rightfully being called the media elite if it's all about, well, we're sitting in our glass tower and deciding what you guys ought to read. Now we can see what they're reading. Now,
isn't that the problem? If they don't know what they want, if you don't give them what's important, that what you know is important, or your reporters find out is important. I mean, you know, what I'm seeing right now is Matt says his fifth grade daughter is interested in journalism. You know, she needs to do an investigative piece on cat videos because that's the combination that is going to do it. And what do you do? How do you tell people, you know, what you know is important, but they don't know it's important until after they get it?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to good journalism, because we all still try to use our brains about what would be important for our audience to know. Our big Sunday package about Medicaid and the endless series of appeals that people are having to go under the privatized model, that struck us as unfair. We went out, did lots of investigative reporting. Jason Clayworth did very fine work on that piece. I would put that very much in kind of, you used to call it spinach journalism, the here, eat this, it's good for you. But what made it powerful was we went out and did the interviews and really documented all the different levels of appeals and all the frustrations. That's good journalism, that's compelling reading, and that drives audience.
Dave Buzik, take
it. Yeah, I think we can get too hung up on this idea that we're only making journalism decisions based on what stories are getting clicked on online. And all it is it's a factor to consider. We learned long ago that we could get web stories to take off if we could figure out a way to put the word stripper in the headline. So sometimes we'd have a good spinach story, and it's like, how are we going to get the word stripper into that headline? And I'm only partially kidding. But it's a factor that we've never had before. We're going to make our journalism decisions on a daily basis based on what we think is the top story and what people ought to know. But we now have this feedback system that tells us where we may not have realized that a story like the Windsor Heights sidewalks was not a huge deal. Now we've got this thing that shows that it's taken off, and then maybe we should go pay attention to that and put a little more resources into it.
Yeah. Aaron Murphy, check in on this, because you're the reporter who's sitting at the table, so
right.
I want to hear you.
I would add exactly to what Dave said. I don't want to, as much as it would be good for me as a competitor of the Register, I don't want people to walk away from here tonight saying, well, the Register said the only reason they do a story is because it it gets clicks or because it helps drive the account. As Dave said, that's it's just part of the – there's still a discussion that happens between a reporter and his editors about news coverage. It's just a new way to get feedback on what you all are reading and what is interesting to you. We're still huddled in our offices, still making those decisions of holding how to hold officials accountable and how to dig in the places and shine the light where it's not being shown. We still do all that. This is just a metric, another way to help inform some of the things we do.
Matt Strawn, let me ask, though, you and I had a discussion about this recently somewhat, and I made this distinction that Michael made between what people ought to know and what people might want to know. And perhaps playing devil's advocate, or perhaps you really believe it, you said that's an elitist distinction. Do you believe that? If so, how do you deal with that question?
You know, and I think it's a fine line to walk. You know, I think if we learned anything in November of 2016, that there is a significant segment of our population that is tired of being talked down to and condescended. So having a handful of people deciding for us what may be news is one thing. And I think there certainly is a gatekeeping function and a role in journalism that has tremendous value. When you start perhaps, you know, seeping that into the, you know, the editorial decisions or the, you know, the op-ed page where, you know, we're telling you what you ought to believe, that's where you start losing a lot of folks on my side of the political aisle. And that belief and what we see coming out of the editorial side or the opinion side of the House can often color what would otherwise be kind of straight line news judgments on what to cover on the news side of the House, if that makes sense.
We've got to get some reaction from the other table.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I can't tell you how many people I've told this, and I don't mind telling because I understand. Aaron Murphy. As a reporter, the editorial side really is completely independent. I know a lot of people probably won't believe that, and I'll do what I can. Come talk to me afterwards. I'll do what I can to convince you. It really is a separate function. I understand that that's not a distinction a lot of people make, and that's a challenge as a reporter. That when it's in the paper, that's your viewpoint too. That's how people see it. I get that, and that's a challenge. But if I can give anybody one thing, if you hadn't heard that before, it is a completely separate function.
And it doesn't, if I can jump in real quick, and it doesn't do you any favors, Aaron, when the President of the United States makes his first trip to Iowa as the Commander-in-Chief, and he is greeted on the front page of the Cedar Rapids Gazette with an editorial blasting him. That's not Iowa nice. That's that's also not a distinction that a lot of voters understand.
But wait a minute, that makes your job more difficult. How about if it had been an editorial saying, this is the greatest president in the world? You'd have liked it, and the Democrats wouldn't. That's what editorial pages do. Editorials do. They take positions. Op-eds take positions. And you don't like them when they go against your position. I don't like them when they go against my position. But that's their function. And you hope that you learn a little from it.
But I can say, as a reporter, I do. Matt's point is fair, that there are a lot of readers and voters who don't make that distinction. I would love, if anybody has a brilliant way to get that message out to the masses, I'm with it.
Well, hasn't there been a growing kind of feeling that any time that you quote a person who is critical, not just of Donald Trump, but of anyone, that implies bias? I mean, it seems to me that, and maybe we can get into a whole definition of what bias is here, but any time that any sort of contrarian view is presented, then that is a view as bias. Can anyone on the journalist side explain the idea of, you know, a balanced report or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fine to Dave. To have. You know, a good story should have facts and then should have a fair representation of opinions about what those facts mean, because facts all by themselves don't necessarily help our viewers and our readers understand things. So you want to have a fair representation of facts and opinions. But when you're talking about something that is clearly not a fact
and the White House is telling you that it is a fact, you know, there's no point in going out and getting another opinion that says that it's a fact when it's not. We have to agree in this society about what the facts are. We just have to agree on a basic set of facts, and then we can argue about what to do about those facts.
I didn't go to journalism school myself, but I always...
Thank God.
Well, somebody had to have an honest living here, but, you know, these professors, what can I say? But, you know, I always liked the phrase I used to hear, which was a journalism quip, evidently, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. And that's the job of a good journalist, and people in power don't like that. And I'm not big on the flowery cliches and everything, but, you know, this notion, speaking truth to power. It doesn't matter what party the power is. Power sometimes doesn't like truth spoken to it. It's part of the game. It's what you have to deal with. And if you want to whine all the time because you feel you're attacked, that's what you signed up for. Now, after a break, we can talk about what we might mean by that very incendiary term, media bias. But at the beginning, that's the function of a free press.
So, Dave, can I ask a question? Do we have time? Troy, so you worked for Governor Culver. Did Governor Culver get tough coverage, in your opinion?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. I mean, and you know, like it, you know, he was governor during a pretty rough time economically. There were a lot of times that I felt that, you know, we got unfair coverage on certain budgetary things or different things. There was a time that the Register did a whole big story about when he did a triathlon, and there happened to be just a random photograph of him wearing
a Speedo.
And that seemed to get a lot of coverage.
The Speedo did. Not as much fun.
Which we felt was unfair, but...
Why is that unfair? He was wearing the Speedo.
It was.
Well, what's unfair about that? If he thought he was going to look like an idiot in a Speedo, which he kind of did, why did you say, oh, yeah, Governor, put on the Speedo?
Well, I didn't tell him to put on the Speedo. I can assure you that. But no, I mean, there have always been times that I felt like we got unfair coverage. But, you know, I don't know. I guess we just didn't scream as loudly about it or other things. But, I mean, we always pointed out, and we always try to maintain working relationships. So.
All right. As Dennis said, we are going to have to take a break. But you know what's next on my list of questions? What was the biggest mistake that you made? And thank you, Troy, for being the first person to answer that question. We're going to take a break, but we will be right back.
Noche is Iowa's premier home for jazz and cabaret. Open Wednesday through Saturday and hosting performers local and national, Noche's throwback cocktail bar and stage ensure a night unlike any other in Central Iowa.
Every night I just bide my time till you are with me again.
Whether it's a night out for a show or throwing your next private event backstage, visit NocheDSM.com for more information right away. That's NocheDSM.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to our second segment of Wonks for a... where we are talking politics and the press. And as promised, just before we took that break, we are going to ask folks to tell us their biggest mistake. So who wants to start?
I'll go.
Okay, Troy, you already told us one. We already have these images of Chet Culver in a Speedo.
His biggest mistake was that he gave him the Speedo.
Take it away, Troy.
So I was a young press staffer in 2006 and was working in the governor's office, working for Governor Vilsack. And we were highlighting different projects that received state funds. Well, we went to this place that makes heparin. It's a blood thinner. Thought, oh, this is a great place. Highlights, it's new economy, all that sort of jazz. Didn't really know how they make heparin. So it's a hot day. It's July. It's 105 degrees. I pull up to the plant. I'm like, boy, something smells a little funny here. Well, come to find out, they tell me how they make heparin, which is they boil pig intestine down until they extract it.
It's the mucus of pig intestines.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
I just want to make sure that
if you really want to get down to brass tacks.
Thank you.
Can we go back to talking about Governor Culver and the Speedo?
No.
Well, so anyway, so we do this press event. The Governor Vilsack shows up. It's hot. He sweats completely through his suit. And the press starts following the governor around. And immediately, once they realize what it is, just start puking. And so it was not a great event. We didn't get a lot of good questions. I don't think we got really our message through that day. But you know what? Yeah, well, it was the worst one that I've done.
All right. Thank you, sir. All right, everybody's going to weigh in on this. I want you to know. We're going to put you all on the
Michael,
point.
What was your, Michael Gartner, what was your biggest mistake or faux pas?
Well, it probably wasn't a real good idea when I said to Gary Gerlach, yeah, let's buy the Register. But when I was at NBC, we had this, just looked like a great story. And so on investigative pieces, I always said I want to read the script as well as watch the video, because when you watch a video, you can get mesmerized. So I was reading the script. Looked good to me. I asked the reporter a few questions and was all set. And later on, it occurred to me, I probably should have said to him, you didn't put a cherry bomb under the truck, did you?
You need to explain that.
No, I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, just Google cherry bombs, trucks, Dateline, and Michael Gartner, and you'll find the answer to that question.
Aaron Murphy, did you blow it any time, or what happened? What's the story?
You know, I was trying to think of some, and not because I'm even remotely perfect, but I couldn't think of anything interesting from my time in politics, but I'm a converted sports writer, and what I do remember doing once, I came down to cover Iowa State Media Day for football. And when I got to the facility, I didn't see a lot of people around yet. I was needing help in which direction to go. And I asked for Coach McCarthy's press conference. And the Iowa State fans are the ones laughing because that's not his name, is Dan McCarthy. And I just felt like a complete idiot walking into the place, not even knowing the name of the guy that I was there to report on.
Congratulations on your credibility, Dave. Dave
Boozy? Yeah. The next day I moved over to politics.
Not quite sure where to begin. I think back in my radio career at WHO Radio, I once said on 50,000 watt clear channel border to border and coast to coast that a flu epidemic had devastated the Italian cities of Rome, Florence, and Naples. Naples!
Matt?
We're going to lose our PG rating between that and the stripper comment. Well, other than thinking that the Arena Football League franchise would be a ticket to riches, I think the crowd is well aware of my largest professional misstep.
No, please tell us.
Yeah. Why don't you ask President Romney?
We may get a chance.
Who did win the 2012 caucuses? Anyway?
We'll never know.
Carol Hunter.
I was editor of the Green Bay Press Gazette in 2000, and that was kind of a close presidential race, some of you might remember. And we're, you know, middle of the night, and do you let the press go, do you not, when do you call it? And I said go when we had AP and CNN. There were three different sources we had looked at and said that Bush had won. And so we went out with about 3,000 papers of Bush winning, and we were not wrong. It just took about 2 months to decide that. But I had some questions in the meantime about that judgment, and didn't realize at the time that basically all three entities were getting their basic call information from the same source. So there was a lot more going back into the, you know, all the calculations that go into making those calls to try to make sure that you actually know what you're talking about before you let the presses roll.
Former anchor Kevin Cooney.
Oh, geez.
I can answer that.
Yeah. I know we all, those in the know all have the same answer. And some of you may actually remember the story that I will relate. But as you know, as the quasi-producer of this particular broadcast, this won't make the podcast. So it'll all be edited out anyway. So. Many years ago, we received a call in the newsroom about 6:25. As a matter of fact, I can tell you for a fact it was 1980 because I had just given my notice to the station that I was going to work in California. And so we got this call about 6:20, 6:25, saying that unfortunately Judge Luther Glanton had passed away. And the person identified themselves as being the Polk County Medical Examiner, Dr. R.C. Wooters. So being the diligent reporter that I did, I started, you know, writing down all the information. And then, this is back in the days before cell phones and stuff, I returned the call because I wanted to verify it. I mean, anybody could just call up, right? And so I called Dr.'s beeper, and I called the doctor's office, and couldn't get any confirmation on it, couldn't get any return call from the doctor, and it's click, 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 you know, the clock is going, and it's almost 6:30, and I've got all the information right here, and I'm typing it up as we go along, and I make the assumption that, you know what, the reason that the doctor's not calling, or that his line is busy, is because he's calling the other media to let them know. So I run the story out to Paul Rhodes, who looks at me, kind of like, are you sure? And it's like, yeah. That's fine. I got a call from Dr. Wooters. So he goes on and reads the story. About 30 seconds after the story airs, Michelle Parker, God rest her soul, picks up the phone in the newsroom and says, yes, yes, Kevin, it's for you. I said, oh, okay. It's Judge Glanton. Okay. And we had been stung. We had been... Someone, for one reason or another, had sent their particular evil direction at us. And so we promptly did a correction. Paul Rhodes did a correction. Paul Rhodes protected me and my identity, saying this person had learned a great lesson. And but what was very interesting is we did a story on it for that night for the 10 o'clock news. And because the county attorney was investigating, perceiving this as a possible threat to Judge Glanton, which would be a very serious event. So what was very interesting is at 9:30, I called up Judge Glanton to double check with him to make sure, you know, everything was okay. And he said, as a matter of fact, he said, I was quite worried because my wife was out shopping at the time the story was on. And he said, I was really worried that, you know, people would, you know, see the story and then see her and say something. Luckily, that didn't happen. But what did happen was this. People, naturally, what happens when somebody dies? You know, you immediately make a casserole and you go over to the person's house. And as Judge Glanton said, you should see the looks on their faces when I answer the door.
We have a couple of questioners at the mic, so let's take questioner number one.
Hi, my name is Amy. I have a question for both the panel.
Do you solemnly swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
We've been over this before. So diversity includes racial, ethnic, gender, sexuality, and political persuasions, and where people went to college. How do you ensure diverse voices, other than those of Missouri grads, are heard in your newsrooms? Thank you.
I don't know what the problem is. With
said the Missouri graduate. Do you want to handle that? Dave, you run a newsroom. How do you handle diversity?
I think it's really important. I don't think we do a very good job at it. I think we could do a much better job at it. I think we have a very collegial process of deciding what stories we're going to cover in the newsroom, and more voices help us make better decisions. It's an issue. There's no question that it's an issue. We try to do the best job we can, and I don't know that you're ever going to get diversity absolutely perfect the way it should be in our business or in any business. So, but it's just something you have to constantly strive at.
I would echo that. It's very, very important. It's been particularly difficult over past decade in a disrupt industry as you're shrinking your workforce. When you don't have openings to hire, then it becomes very difficult to keep diversifying your workforce. I think it is true that many people come into journalism with, I don't want to say a bias, because we, although I will say we're all biased, but with a leaning perhaps toward more of a liberal philosophy. I don't ask that in interviews, because that's not part of what, people are supposed to set aside those biases. But I have had conservatives in the newsroom say that it's hard being a conservative in a newsroom. So that makes me know that ideology as a part of diversity is important too.
It's not a problem on a baseball team.
Think about the cultural diversity. In addition to gender, race, sexual orientation, when you look at the national media, I know that is something that, as a conservative and as a Republican, not seeing cultural diversity in the national media is something that frustrates us greatly. Watching the national reporting after Trump's victory, where these national journalists go out into the wild like it's a safari and they're in Appalachia or in eastern Ohio or in places like Ottumwa, in Burlington, and oh my goodness, who are these Trump voters, this anthropological project that they couldn't identify with? They didn't see it coming. So, there is an inherent cultural bias, perhaps, with many in the national media that, be it where they were educated or just their peer group, in a society that is self-segmenting as fast as we are, that's something as a conservative and a Republican that concerns me greatly, especially with the national media.
Let me ask.
They should hire Ann Selzer. She would have predicted it. That's a plug, Ann.
Are you suggesting there's a deliberate plot, if you will, to keep Republicans and conservatives out of newsrooms? If not, and I don't think you are, then why aren't there in newsrooms? Isn't it the free market? And you just, that's Republican orthodoxy, the free market. You go where you want to go to get a job.
Yeah,
why aren't there conservatives and Republicans?
Well, I'm a one-man focus group, and I decided for my career path leaving J school that law school and business and, some form of government service followed by business was going to be my path because it was the best way to provide for myself and my family. That's the decision I made.
So is it that conservatives and Republicans simply choose not to go into journalism? Is that the problem basically you're wrestling with?
Well, I would actually ask this question of those that are involved in the national media newsrooms, that where are they hiring from? Are they looking to the J School at the University of Iowa, or is it a handful of Northeastern colleges where it's relationship-driven and, only those that come from an upper middle class background have the ability to take a very low paying job just to get a foot in the door, while those that have to get by and scrape a little more never see those opportunities. We see that in politics all the time. It's the sons and daughters of the well-heeled that get the internships in politics. And I would submit in the national media that you're seeing a lot of that happen as well.
But Michael, you headed up the national media at NBC. Did you see any of that? Or did, when it came to your hiring, was cultural diversity in terms of conservative and liberal or anything along those lines considered?
Can I interrupt real quick? I don't mean ideologically, though. It's even just when I say cultural, I don't mean on a political spectrum, but understanding the lives of those in rural America that didn't grow up in the coasts or in an urban environment.
Well, perhaps the greatest reporter at NBC when I was there, who I put on the air, was a guy named Tim Russert, and his father was, I believe, a garbage man in Buffalo. So, I don't think it makes any difference how you grew up, and I don't think that maybe you get your foot in the door if your father was the president of Merck or something, but I don't think it lasts.
Russer did awfully well.
Pardon me?
Luke Russert did awfully well.
Not in television at the moment.
Anymore, okay.
But Tim did a spectacular job. I don't think that Katie Couric grew up wealthy. I know Bryant, I don't think Bryant Gumbel grew up wealthy. I don't know if Willard Scott ever grew up. I don't know what Brokaw's dad did, but he was from South Dakota. I don't think you look at that. I just think you look at the talent, and which takes a lot of different abilities to do that. I got in a big argument when I was NBC with the National Alliance of Gay and Lesbian Journalists. They came to me, and I knew the guy, the heads of it, and they came to me and they wanted to know what NBC's stand was on hiring gays. And I said, what do you mean? He says, what's your stand on hiring gays? And I says, our stand is I don't give a shit. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, I don't care. Well, how many do you have? I said, I don't know. Well, why don't you know? I said, do you want me to go ask everybody if they're gay? I said, do you want me to bring people out of the closet? What do you want me to do? I said, we hire based on talent. And I said, I assume 5 to 10% of the staff is gay, because 5% to 10% of America is gay. And so I never understood this emphasis. We got a huge argument about it, in which I said, well, I got a complaint. I said, how come gay men don't have their own word? And they said, what do you mean? I said, well, lesbians, you've got lesbians. What's the equivalent of a gay man? I said, I think you're discriminating against gay men. And so then we went round and round on that, and it ended up reasonably unpleasant, I guess. But about 3 weeks later, I got a call from the publisher of the Wall Street Journal, my friend Peter Kahn, who had been visited by the National Association of Gay Reporters, or whatever it's called. And he said, what'd you tell them what your policy was? And I told him, I said, why? He said, well, they came down and they asked me, and he said, I pulled out all these numbers, and they said, why don't you have the same policy Gartner has at NBC? He said, that's what you ought to do. You shouldn't ask people. And so maybe it worked. I don't know. But that's a tough, difficult decision, you know, especially with gays. I mean, it's pretty easy to tell that a black person's black most of the time, and it's pretty easy to tell that an Asian person's Asian. Pretty hard to tell whether a gay person is gay or not. So what are you supposed to do? I just figured nature takes its course.
Troy?
Sorry, I know we're supposed to be interviewing the press, but of course, Chairman Emeritus, I have a couple of comments on what you said. Obviously, all of us strive to make sure, no matter what role we're in, to make sure that there's a wide range of diverse voices. But you mentioned something that in politics, most of the jobs go to people who are legacy people. I guess I can't speak to the Republican experience, but I can tell you that, like, on the Democratic side, I mean, I'm from Cedar County. I'm a gay kid who grew up the parents of a couple of working class parents. My parents install furnaces and air conditioners. And so, and I know, like, many of my friends that are in politics, some of whom are here tonight, aren't coming from legacies. We can always, there's every industry will have someone who was, whether it's the media, whether it's politics, whether it's whatever, someone who is affected by that. But I want to say that politics is the one business that I know. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what your background is, that you can get ahead, you can do well, you can do great, and you can help change the world.
Okay. Even if you're born into a wealthy New York real estate family.
Well, we've got
well said.
We've got folks lined up here to ask questions, so go ahead. Name, address, serial number, whatever.
Laura Bellin. I do some political reporting myself, and when you were talking about mistakes, I was thinking about some of the biggest mistakes that we've seen on a national scale, like career-ending mistakes in some cases, or, you know, major retractions from major media organizations, and often it's because anonymous sources led the journalists astray. And I know that, you know, confidential sources and tipsters are very valuable, and there's no way around relying on them to some extent, but I feel that I would like to see more people in the media burn sources who lie to them and say, if you, our agreement to keep your name confidential is no longer operative once I find out that you've misled our news organization. And so I'd like the journalists and the editors to answer, under what circumstances would you burn a source who lied? And if the answer is never, then why not?
I think what you said is the standard. I think what you said is the standard position, Lori, that you say, I'll protect you as long as I believe you are telling the truth. Now, if it turns out the source was wrong, but the source was acting in good faith and thought she was right or he was right, that's okay. But if they're using you and they know their line, you burn them right away.
But I don't. Do you think that actually happens?
Yes.
Because when sources who lie are burned, because I don't see it happening much.
Well, I think it happens. I've done it.
Yeah, I would agree. As a reporter, that's a pretty easy bar. If you're reliable, that's obviously one thing. And as soon as we have evidence that you're not, then I'm not coming back to you. I mean, it's pretty. I've not had that happen to me yet, which is maybe why my biggest mistake was so boring and I had to go back to sports. But that seems to me a pretty easy bar.
I agree that I think that is the standard. I can't think of a time where we've then outed someone, but I think mostly it's because of as Michael said, it's because people, they believe it, even if all of your reporting turns out to say it's not supportable. But I don't think I can think of a time when someone has intentionally fed us bad information.
Next questioner.
Heather Prezik. I find on my news feed people all the time that post articles supporting their own opinion from dubious news sources. Everyone on social media, and both sides are guilty of this, live in their own little bubbles where their positions are supported. And nobody seems to try to really make an effort to get outside their little bubbles. How do you, as the news media, try to penetrate people's bubbles? I mean, we now live in an age where you can see video of a starving polar bear taken by a reporter or a photographer from National Geographic, and half the people will scream fake news because they don't want to believe in global warming. How do you get outside of people's bubbles with facts when we can't even decide on what facts are anymore?
If anybody has a real good slam dunk answer to this, you've got a six-figure salary waiting for you at any media organization in the country. I agree that it's an issue, and from a reporter's standpoint, all I can do is just keep doing what I do and communicate with the public and do what I can to get eyeballs on my stories and just keep doing a fair job. Beyond that, as a reporter, part of this has to be a behavior change from the news consumer too. I hate to sound like I'm punting the problem to someone else here. But as you noted, people are just seeking out information that already confirms their preconceived biases. As a reporter, all I can do is just keep doing my job the right way and get my work out there and hope that people value that and make their judgments based on what I hope is fair work. Beyond that, I don't have a great answer for this massive question that's facing all of us.
Maybe Ben Strong does.
Well, I don't know if I have that six-figure answer that Aaron mentioned, but part of the challenge is we may not even get to make that decision for ourselves. When you talk about, earlier we're talking about, okay, we should be in the business of putting together the news you ought to know. Well, you know who's making that choice for us? Facebook, Google, the algorithms. If I've already clicked on one story that has confirmed my bias, you know what's going to happen? The other stories curating in my feed are going to be confirming that bias. So, this challenge is far beyond, just the individual news organizations. It's how news is curated and delivered to us today. But then look at our politics. And this isn't I don't think this is a Republican or Democrat comment, but you look at our politics are no longer about persuasion. They're about mobilization. My job is to get more of my side out in November than Troy gets of his side out. My job isn't necessarily to go find that mythical swing voter, who, by and large, doesn't really exist much anymore. I just need to find the one that leans a little bit more to my side and tweak them. Now, whether that's by motivating them about the boogeyman that the other side may be, or whether finding out that real sweet spot that will turn them out. You know, Heather, that's the frustrating part of this, because our communication delivery systems, our peer groups, everything has been so segmented. That's how we're getting our information. And then when you look at how we're mobilizing ourselves for elections, it's not about persuading others that we're right. It's about making sure we're persuading our own that the other side's wrong.
Michael Gartner, you wanted to talk about the relationship between reporters and their sources, or politicians in particular.
I didn't necessarily want to talk about it. I just thought it was a subject that is pretty interesting. Political reporters, especially, are surrounded by politicians all day. They become friendly. It's a kind of a symbiotic relationship or parasitic relationship. And how does that always work? You know, how's the friendship work? I mean, I love politicians, and they're fun to be around. They're great to be around. Art New was the greatest guy in the world to be around. He was funny. He was smart. We became great friends. But I often wondered when I was there, what if New had done something really awful? You know, I mean, it really would have been very hard to write that. You would have written it, but it would have been very hard. He was one time, he and I started having breakfast every couple of weeks. We were both early risers down at the basement of Moran's on Locust. And one day we were down there and we were all alone. And I says, listen, New, I says, there's nobody in the place. I says, you've been all over the state of Iowa. What is the shittiest city in Iowa? And he didn't break stride. He says, Leon. At which point, the waitress who was standing there says, Leon, that's my hometown. At which point, New says, and that's why I'll never be governor. You develop these great relationships. So I think it's a very interesting dynamic, and you see reporters hanging out with
Aaron, talk about that. I mean, you're the reporter at the
desk. Yeah, I think Michael kind of answered his own question within his story there. It is pretty simple, and I hate to be a one-trick pony here and fall back on another sports story, but I have this memory etched in my mind of way back when I was very young, middle school age, and we had some kind of field trip or with an organization, I don't know what it was. We got to tour the Milwaukee Brewers baseball facility and heard from different speakers throughout the day, and one of them was the beat writer for the Milwaukee paper. And I had no aspirations of journalism back then, but for whatever reason, the thought, he took some questions, and the question I thought of at the time was, you see these players every single day all summer, 162 games, every day you travel, follow them around the country. Do you develop, do some of these players become your friends? Do you develop relationships with them? And the writer said, yeah, to be honest, to a certain extent we do, but they have to know at the end of the day that I'm going to write about them, good or bad. If they screw up, I'm going to write that too. And that's essentially what it boils down to. Yeah, we work alongside these. I'm a State House reporter. We see them every day, especially the ones who sit right next to Press Row. We really get to know those guys. And you get to know them on a personal level, and some of them you like, some of them you don't like. But at the end of the day, they have to know that we're there for two different reasons, and I have a job to do. And when I have to write that story that you may not like or may paint you in an unflattering light, as long as it's still fair, that's my job. That's what I got to do. I'm not here to protect you.
Dave Buzik.
Well, the relationship has to be with an understanding that if a tough story needs to be done, a tough story needs to be done. But this has been going on for years and years and years. And some of you in this room are old enough to remember the Mingo party in Jasper County, in a small town where it was legislators, lobbyists, and press, went to this party at a bar called the Back 40. Okay, people in this room do remember that, and some people in this room live in Mingo, in fact, along the back wall there.
I was in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's right. So what happened was they were all there having a party, and there was a sex act performed. in the bar on a sitting state senator. Well, I don't know if he was sitting or standing, but it was a state senator. And the story didn't come out for a couple of days, and KCCI, we had a reporter there. And I said, well, how could you not report on this? And she said, because it was off the record. And it was like, it was off the record. What if somebody had walked in with a gun and shot the state senator? Would that be off the record too? And the funny story about it is, of course, that when the press started coming out, everybody, the story started coming out about it. Everybody started asking the politicians, did you see this? Did you see this? Did you see this? And everybody was in the kitchen. Apparently nobody saw it. This little bar in Tiny Mingo has got the world's largest kitchen for a bar.
And it was your chance to get stripper in a headline, and you didn't do it.
Well, it was... Al Gore had not invented the internet yet, so we couldn't do it. And that state senator was reelected by a wide margin up in Woodbury County.
Well, we have come to the end of our evening. Oh, but wait a minute. There's one final questioner. It appears to be a former registered reporter, at least judging by the profile I can see here. Would you identify yourself and agree to your Miranda warning?
My name is Tom Witoski, and I was one of the guys who covered the Mingo story.
Were you there?
No. I was told that it was off the record, and I was invited, and I was told it was off the record, and I remember a sage old reporter telling me, "Don't you ever, ever, agree to something like that." So I didn't. The next day after the party, I had a reporter sit down next to me and tell me everything that happened. And I said to myself, why in the world did you tell me that? And it had to be a story.
Did you break the story, Tom?
Yeah, we did. It was me, Jay Norman, Dave Yepsen, which is sort of interesting because it sort of parallels the shithouse story or shithole story. Everybody, some people are complaining that it was the Democrat that ratted out Donald Trump. Well, it was a Republican that ratted out Mingo. His name was Roger Halverson. He was the only Republican that was at the party. So, I mean, the door swings both ways. And and he was a state representative. His name was Al Sturgeon at the time. And after
I think it still is.
Yeah, it is. But he was elected to the state Senate after the story broke, which tells you in Sioux City getting, well, anyway, we don't need to go into that.
We're looking at the end now for this evening. I just want to give our panelists
a chance. I thought you meant in general.
Well, aren't we all?
Well, that too.
Final thoughts. Final thoughts. What should we take away in your mind, the best thing to take away about the question of the politics in the press? Aaron?
You know, I'll maybe just say, and hopefully your question is open-ended enough that I'm okay to go on this tangent.
Not sports.
Not sports this time, for once. As a reporter, what I would say to anyone out there is, and this whole fake news thing is, just reach out to someone. Reach out to me. Reach out to whoever. You think there's something wrong with the story? Email the reporter. I promise you 90% of them will get back to you. And if you're open-minded, and they'll explain to you the process. I think the one thing that we can do right now in the media is be even more transparent than we've ever been. And not that we haven't been before, we just maybe never felt the need to be. To anyone out there, whether it's in this room or anyone listening on the podcast, I would encourage you, if you've got an issue with the press, you take it right to them. Call the reporter, call the editor, and I promise you, you'll get an explanation.
I think that print reporters have to be ever diligent not to go on television. I think that you're, first of all, you like being on television. Your mom likes it. But you lose a little bit. Every time you go on, you lose a little bit of your reputation of being fair and unbiased.
Just being on television, does it?
Yes, I think it does. I think that's what happened to you, Kevin, early in your life.
Seriously, why?
Because you're answering questions instead of asking questions. And and the tone of voice, and it just damages it. And I think it's much, much harder to be a political reporter for television than it is for the print for that very reason, because you can see the body language, you can see all that, whereas you can't in print. I mean, in print, a guy might be taking notes, and over in the sideline, he might be writing, "This is the dumbest son of a bitch I've ever met in my life." But you don't know that. You don't know he's thinking that. You can't hide that when you're on television. And I think that if I were still running a newspaper, God forbid, I would say, you guys can't go on television.
Anybody else?
I just want to say thanks to all of you for sharing these insights tonight. I mean, this has been actually interesting to be on the other side of this, because typically you're the ones who were asking me questions. So I want to say thank you. And I just want to echo what Aaron said, that, you know, when I first got into starting to do press and, as a political operative, it was, you know, I was terrified of the media and terrified of reporters. I'm like, oh, they're going to find a way to screw me one way or the other. And that's just not the case. And I have I've got great friends who are members of the press corps, and I want to say thank you for the work that you folks do to help keep us honest, even though I don't really like it when you do. But I do want to say thank you for the work that you folks do every day.
Thank you, Troy.
I guess I would put in a pitch to support local journalism.
Yeah.
Whether it's the folks at KCCI or Lee Newspapers or the Register.
Or the Business Record.
Or the Business Record.
Or City View.
Yes. we see ourselves
or Lori's blog.
That's true. As acting on the public's behalf. And we do take your calls, and I really encourage people to be skeptical readers and to ask us all sorts of questions, because we're always calling for transparency, and others, we need to be transparent about how we've gathered the news, about our sourcing. We need to do everything we can to show that this isn't fake news. We have the facts.
All right, Carol, thank you very much for that. And that's it for this edition of Wonks. We are going to have to end things at that. Thanks to our panel, Dave Buzik, Carol Hunter, Aaron Murphy, and Michael Gartner. Thanks also to Democratic State Chairman Troy Price and former Republican Chairman Matt Strawn. A special shout-out to Noche and Max Wellman, Brandon Gedler, and Maria Filippone here at Noche. Our audio engineer at Noche up there is one Josh Jepson. He is amazing. Our post-production audio editor and website producer is J. Alex Cooney. The executive producer in charge of our conscience is Robert Davis, and my co-anchor and the real brains behind the show is Dennis Goldford. From all of us at Wonks, thank you very much. We'll be right back.